Welcome to Fortress on a Hill. I'm Henry.
I'm Danny.
I'm Kagan.
We're three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and to illuminate the damage military service does to Americans.
American presidents throughout U.S. history have used American military and diplomatic power to force regime change of democratically elected governments around the world.
Most veterans come from families vested in prior service, and American generals choose their own, ensuring diversity of thought never interferes with American warmongering.
How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists when nothing could be more false?
Fortress on a Hill aims to change that.
Hi, well, welcome everybody to another episode of Fortress on a Hill. We are really, really excited to have our guest today, Stuart Schrader. Stuart is the author of Badges Without Borders, How Global Counterinsurgency Transformed American Policing. Before we get started, just a little intro here to give you a little bit of background. Stuart is the Associate Director of the Program in Racism, Immigration, and Citizenship, and a lecturer slash assistant research scientist at Johns Hopkins University. He's also affiliated with the 21st Century Cities Initiative and received his PhD in American Studies from NYU in 2015. Before coming to Johns Hopkins, he was a postdoctoral fellow at the Charles Warner Center at Harvard University and the Center for the United States and the Cold War at the Tamament Library at New York University. At Johns Hopkins, he teaches courses on police and prisons, black social movements, and critical race theory. Well, Stuart, welcome. Thank you for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get started with a little more details, could you give the listeners kind of a brief overview about your book and kind of your goals with writing it?
Sure. Badges Without Borders is a history of the program of police assistance to other countries that the United States developed during the Cold War. The book focuses on the period from 1945 to about 1975, with the main interest in the decade of the 1960s. The United States in this period provided assistance to police in 52 countries around the globe. Some of those assistance programs were short-lived. Some of them lasted for two decades. The assistance consisted of three primary domains. What was called technical assistance, which means, helping the aid recipient countries, build up new capabilities. So a classic example would be a crime laboratory or a fingerprint data management system. So technical assistance was one, training was the other. The United States trained police from the 52 countries that I mentioned, as well as another 25, where they never actually had assistance programs on the ground. For the training, police would come from around the world to the United States, and the academy that the United States operated was called the International Police Academy, and it was in Washington, D.C. And then finally, the third component, the costliest and largest component in some ways, was the provision of material assistance. So what that meant was that the United States gave police in other countries all types of goods that they might need. Some of these were totally mundane, handcuffs, cameras, radios, and then some were more sophisticated. And of course, it included, weapons, obviously firearms and bullets, as well as tear gas. So I look at this program of police assistance across the globe, in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and I analyze how, assisting police in other countries involved police, leading police experts from the United States, who were the type of people who would write the textbooks for police in the United States, who would, lead classes at academies and colleges across the United States who were police chiefs in important locales. These folks went overseas to assist police, but of course they also came back home. And so a big part of the book is, in addition to looking at how the United States works with police across the country, then to look at how this affects policing in the United States. And in particular, in the 1960s, how the political protests and upheaval associated with the civil rights and Black Power movements was met with new forms of aggressive types of policing that were shaped by this overseas program. And I go into a number of dimensions of influences. I look at training in riot control. I look at the introduction of the chemical CS for riot control, also known as tear gas. I look at the development of the SWAT team. And I look at the development of new bureaucracies in the federal government to wage war on crime. The phrase war on crime was used by the Johnson and Nixon administrations in this period. And there's a number of other things I look at in the book that we can talk about.
So I'm curious, having, you know, book came out fall last year, and the last 2 or 3 months, many of the book's subjects have been just swirled around as to what's happening in our country, mass protests against police brutality. I'm wondering what has really struck you or maybe surprised you about this moment in history, you know, the heavily militarized police presence and response, unmarked federal agents in military uniforms. What do you think about all that, Stuart?
Well, I would say that in some ways I am, you know, of course horrified, but I'm also not totally surprised. I do think that it's important to recognize that, you know, 2020 is a long way from the 1960s. A lot has happened in between. So I would be hesitant to say that, you know, what I write about in the book, which concludes around 1975, has a direct and decisive role in shaping, you know, any individual story that is in the news today. On the other hand, I hope that my book shows that it's impossible to understand the development of policing in the United States from the 60s forward without contextualizing it in relation to U.S. empire, war overseas, and the really strong ideological component to policing, which is about, you know, quelling political dissidents and constraining social movements and collective action for change in the United States and around the world. I think that what we're seeing right now in the United States would be both recognizable and somewhat surprising to some of the historical actors that I look at in the 1960s. On the one hand, they were wary of the ways that police response to protests could intensify and worsen protests. That's a key theme that I examine in the book, which has interesting consequences. But I think so. They would understand and recognize how police have made things worse right now. I think they would be a little bit taken aback at the Trump administration's unwillingness to try to rein this in, and I think, you know, it's more than just unwillingness. I think it's an active effort to provoke and incite violence. So I think that some of my historical actors would recognize it. I think they would be a little bit alarmed and surprised, but they would also be quite surprised at how different the funding landscape is for police in the United States. In the 1960s, it was challenging for police to have enough resources to accomplish their everyday tasks, as well as their kind of emergency and crisis management tasks. And a big focal point of the book is looking at how police use their experience of being enrolled in the project of assisting police in other countries, how they use that experience to then make new demands on the federal government to get funding for law enforcement, which ultimately was successful, and is typified in the 1968 federal anti-crime bill. Fast forward from 1968 to 2020, and there is a lot more money available for police coming from the federal government and certainly at state and local levels. So that kind of challenge of figuring out where will the resources come from that I think police felt, hindered them in police experts felt hindered police in the 60s is now much less of a problem. Now police have basically all the resources they need at their fingertips, particularly at the federal level. And just the one last thing I would say on this point is that the other thing, as I raise the police at the federal level, the other thing that would be quite surprising to my historical actors that I look at is the willingness and even eagerness of the Trump administration to use federal law enforcement officers to engage in, policing of non-federal offenses. I think that in the 1960s, local police wouldn't have stood for that. And police experts who are operating kind of at the national level would have been very wary of it because they would have worried about the ways that it echoed the what they would have considered totalitarianism of the pre-World War II period and of course what they believed was true of the Soviet Union. So they would have been wary of this and surprised by it. And I think that is a distinctive difference now. Of course, it's certainly true that there were federal law enforcement agencies in the 1960s, the FBI most prominent among them. But they did not operate in quite the way we're seeing police are operating today in cities like Portland.
I have so many questions and places I want to take it, but for sort of like honing in on some of the stuff that you're talking about here, because I think the thesis is really important to your book, and it's been described in some reviews as like a smoking gun book, right? Which is pretty cool and I think rare, maybe overused, but in this case I think totally accurate. So one of the misunderstandings that I think maybe you could help clarify is I often hear, the police have always, it's always been this way. The police have always operated this way. Why do we want to change it now? How can we defund or abolish? What does that even mean? And it's understandable if you don't know the background. But I guess my question is based on your research, and obviously, you'll focus more on your specific area temporarily, but how old or new is sort of the contemporary policing model we're seeing, and what changed most about it in the period you specifically study?
It's a good question. I mean, I do think that one of the takeaways of my book should be that in terms of function, police, we can point to a lot of continuities for police. But in terms of kind of institutional organization, police have changed somewhat significantly from the beginning of the 20th century to the present. Understanding police function as being relatively static, of course, even as many things are changing in American society, I think is crucial. The key function that police maintain has been to support and uphold capitalist social relations, to maintain the easiest way to put it would be to maintain the color line, which of course has geographic dimensions, but has many other social dimensions, to protect private property, to, and as I said earlier, to, quell political dissidents in various ways. All of those functions have been persistent, but the ways that police accomplish these goals has shifted, in part in response to, you know, transformations in the broader society, and certainly in response to changing, you know, economic situations and economic fortunes in the country. When we look at the early part of the 20th century, police at the municipal level in cities, you know, generally were connected to local political machines. And as I show in my book, through the middle of the 20th century, those political machines, you know, were mostly, they were mostly dismantled, and a lot of the corruption that was associated with them was alleviated. Police, the way that the transformation of police occurred with the dismantling of the political machines was that police were professionalized. This is a term that I use a lot in the book, and it's, you know, a standard term that is used among historians of policing. What that means is that police became independent from political control. They became answerable more to the internal hierarchy of police departments than to the political whims of the elites in various areas. Professionalization of policing, you know, meant that they would not only be politically independent, but they would also, you know, change the criteria through which police were hired. If previously police were hired because of their political loyalties, and literally police would just, you know, write a letter to a political boss and say, you know, my grandfather was a Democrat, my father was a Democrat, I'm a Democrat, and I will work for the Democratic Party in, you know, City X, you know, as hard as I can. Please make me a police officer, and they would get the job, you know, something like that. Now, under the professionalization schema, police would have to pass an entrance exam. They would have to fulfill certain types of requirements in terms of education. They would have to be literate, which was not always the case beforehand. And then they would go through a somewhat rigorous training process. You know, I don't want to indicate that it was too rigorous, but they would go through a training process and a probationary period, and they would become police. And when they did their job, they would be influenced by advances in you know, criminalistics, which was a way of describing the process of investigation using forensic technologies to track down suspects in crimes and so forth. All of that went hand in hand with professionalization. And this process I show in the book was a global process. The leaders of the professionalization process took their experience and their knowledge around the globe. And what became crucial during the Cold War, as I sort of hinted, was that these policing experts looked at other parts of the globe and they saw analogies between the corrupt political machines in the United States and the political situations in other countries, where they felt that democracy and a kind of more liberal political situation had been hindered by the close control of the police by you know, political elites and leaders in many countries. And so they thought, well, if we could institute administrative and technical reforms in the United States to get police out from the political control of the machines in the cities, surely we can do the same thing in other countries. Now, they were somewhat mistaken in their belief that it would be easy to just you know, kind of break the political control that other countries' leaders held over their police. But nonetheless, that was at least the effort. And that professionalization project as the kind of defining feature of policing within the United States, I would say, lasts until the 1980s. I mean, it continues up to the present, of course. There is certainly a deep effort to, you know, use the latest technologies, engage in large amounts of training for police, both before they, you know, become officers and also at in-service training. All of that continues. But I do think that there's a shift, which I don't really go into the book because it's after the book is concluded. I think there's a shift that begins around the 1980s and really, you know, culminates perhaps in 2020. I mean, that will remain to be seen. but which is the development of police as a kind of political force in the United States. Once they're no longer under the political control of the machines in the early part of the 20th century, by the mid-20th century when they emerge from that control as independent, they then become a certain type of political actor, I would argue, where they're now, if anything, I think we could say, they're controlling elected officials in many places. They are threatening to withhold their labor if they don't get what they want. They're bullying mayors, you know, on social media or other elected officials on social media. They're making their political choices very clear, and oftentimes their political choices have to do with, well, what type of resources will police receive? How big will the budget be? You know, will their contract be a good contract, and so forth? So that kind of, you know, using their political independence to get what they want, you know, starts to diverge a little bit from the functions of policing that we were, you know, talking about a minute ago. So, of course, it still remains the case that police are involved in quelling political dissent. We see that happening, of course, right now before our very eyes. But I also think that the flavor of it is a little bit different. Of course, it's no surprise that police are, you know, cracking down on protests against racism. They're cracking down on what they perceive as left-wing protests. But I think there's a very specific flavor to what's happening right now, which is that protesters are, they're focusing their protests on police budgets. They're focusing their protests on the political power of police. And I think that's inciting police to be, in some ways, extra vigorous and more cruel and aggressive in their response to the protests, because they are seeing their kind of political project of using their power to you know, be well funded being targeted directly through the slogan of defund the police. And so I think that we're starting to see the police response to these protests diverge a little bit from what we might normally think of as police control of protests, which is really just about you know, maintaining order, you know, keeping the streets clear, so on and so forth. I think there's a different kind of ideological or political flavor to it that I think is important to pay attention to.
Just as a quick follow-on to that, I think that was one of the things that was most interesting to me about, you know, a bunch of your writing that I've read, even non-academic stuff, about this professionalism theme. Because, you know, we do a lot of military interviews. Obviously, we're both veterans and write about this sort of stuff. But the military as well, and of course I think you're going to be able to bring up a lot of linkages here then and now, the military as well has had this sort of like cult of professionalism that really particularly becomes the way when we get rid of the draft, right? So we sort of go towards this volunteer, we're going to be professionals, we're going to be warriors, this is a profession, right? This isn't a citizen soldier anymore. And in some ways, while there are differences, that appears to parallel some of the policing development and the politicization that comes from that, despite the fact that, for example, in the military, they claim to be apolitical, right? Which has, of course, never truly been the case. But, you know, someone will say the word professionalism, and the immediate assumption is that's got to be a net positive, right? And so I think that's what's interesting is that you're pointing out, and I don't know if you can expand at all on the dark side of that professionalism, but also perhaps just a touch or an intro, because I'm sure we'll go in a lot of directions on some of these connections, right, between the institutions of the military and the police. And then, of course, there's a lot of operational stuff as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. I hadn't quite thought of it in exactly those terms. You know, in part because I'm mostly thinking about the military in my work in the period of the draft. But I would say that the professionalism, as you indicate, it, you know, is a kind of double-edged sword, so to speak. On the one hand, it has this kind of technical aspect. And I think that, if anything, the professionalization of police in the 20th century, if we think of that as a, you know, multi-decade trend, I think is really inherited from the military. Many of the key figures who are associated with the move to professionalize policing are themselves military veterans of, you know, the Spanish-American War and various campaigns after that. Most famously, August Vollmer, who's sort of the grandfather of professional policing. You know, he's a veteran of counterinsurgency in the Philippines, although he wouldn't have used that term. He adopts military manuals that he had, you know, experienced in his, you know, in the training that he underwent in the military. He adopts those types of manuals in the police department that he runs in Berkeley. And then ultimately he opens a division of the University of California in Berkeley that is dedicated to educating police. So I think that we can see that technical side that has to do with, you know, say expertise in shooting your firearm. And expertise in patrol methods. We can see that coming straight out of the military experience. But then the other side of the sword is, I think, what you're referring to, which is the way that professionalism indicates a certain autonomy from external oversight. Professionalism means, just the same way that I, as a college professor, you know, I would say I should not be, you know, subject to the oversight of, any, you know, random person who doesn't have a PhD. I should answer to other people with PhDs who are also college professors who have some sense of what this job entails when they evaluate me. Or, you know, a medical doctor would, of course, say the same thing. And this may be breaking down, you know, before I was in the pandemic, but medical doctors would say, you know, the average person on you know, social media should not have any say in how medicine, professional medicine is operating. You know, we should answer to people who are similarly trained. So I think that police and military have a very similar attitude, and it makes sense. I don't think that it's particularly surprising, but in the case of policing, particularly, it becomes dangerous potentially when police use their professionalism as a way to resist any type of oversight or control from the public, who, of course, you know, according to the slogan, they're supposed to be protecting and serving. When they say, you know, look, we should only answer to our internal hierarchy, our internal modes of discipline, and there should be no civilian control. And in fact, as they said in the 60s, and I think this is kind of latent in what is being said today, civilian control is basically a communist plot to, you know, weaken the police. That's where professionalism becomes somewhat terrifying, because it's meant to insulate and allow police to, in some sense, get away with whatever they want to try to get away with, and it has grave political consequences. And certainly, we can't understand the kind of history of racism in policing without looking at that unwillingness to be held accountable for abuses and illegal and unjust acts.
So I'd like to shift gears here just a little bit. I heard you make a comment on an episode of The Dig you were on recently, where you were discussing about cops' desire to be sent to the big fight, you know, to have the feds sent in, to have, you know, when quote unquote shit gets real, for ways that us soldiers would say. And after I heard you say that, it reminded me of years and years ago. I was on a ride along with a small sheriff's department. They only have two deputies on during the night shift. And I asked one of the deputies, you know, generally all the other times that I had been working the road, whether as an MP or as a reserve police officer, there were lots of other people around. But he was going to be by himself in this very, very large county. And I was curious, you know, what would he do if he came upon a violent situation with no backup nearby? And he calmly said he would either wait to arrest someone or possibly distract them in some way until backup was available. But then he said that the most important part was that he went into his calls understanding that backup may not be immediately available. I feel like most police officers have that mindset, that because they know that they're in an area where multiple agencies might respond to something if they happen to really, really call for help. But how does that mitigate the risk factors of being in that dangerous situation without immediately reacting to violence? And especially when it comes to SWAT type tactical teams, cops know that if they don't have their team called out, you know, it's possible that the budget could get reduced or the team downsized. Not so much these days, but like you were mentioning at one time, it was much, much harder for them to go on these little projects. And that by and large, SWAT teams are used for drug busts and high risk warrants, not the super difficult work of rescuing hostages or maybe removing a barricaded subject. But the being unleashed, you know, this immediate move to violence, you know, it shouldn't be a strategy. You know, Mr. Burns saying release the hounds can't be seen as a solid strategy to control crime, even if they want it to be. But the reality is that being unleashed, whatever we want to call it, is a police tactic that they're very defensive about. What happened to Martin Gugino in Buffalo with the SWAT team there, you know, the having these 47 officers resign from the team, that's the response to the slightest bump in the SWAT road, the slightest procedural inconvenience. They would rather ignore the assault their comrades caused than feel their team status diminished, assuming they cared in the first place. And so I say all of that to say this, Stuart, what do you think this mindset, this desire to go to the big show, to be unleashed, says about where American policing is headed in terms of accountability? I asked myself about, is this why there were those reports that police departments actively recruit less intelligent people? You know, we've seen that with the military, that they, you know, that it, not specifically that they want dumb people, but they don't want people beyond a certain type of intelligence. Is this why veterans are desired so much? So what do you think about this mindset, and where do you think it bodes for the future of police accountability?
I think that the way you've laid it out, in some ways, you know, answers the question, and I agree with what you're saying. It's hard to envision a way for accountability to be compatible with this kind of aggressive attitude, this desire to be unleashed. You know, over the past couple months, as I've been watching the footage that so many people have been, you know, posting on social media from protests, so often it looks like police are, you know, in some sense, they're just cracking their knuckles and getting ready for a fight when they approach protesters. And, you know, of course, we will hear the justification that protesters are being abusive, that they're, you know, saying awful things, and potentially, you know, they're throwing, you know, bottles of water at the police lines and various other things like that. But in general, if the idea is to confront, you know, peaceful protesters who are ostensibly, you know, exercising constitutionally protected rights, which, you know, some might question whether we can actually say that such a thing exists given what's happening. You know, it's hard to imagine how we could develop mechanisms of accountability that would not just be completely submerged by this attitude. If what ends up being the, you know, legitimate approach of police being this you know, deep form of aggression, this sense of, which I think is combined with fear, you know, the sense that any encounter could spin out of control and turn into a fatal encounter, you know, a shootout or some other type of violence. You know, this notion that police in any situation might be under attack, might come under attack, is, you know, it gives a lot of license to their behavior. And so figuring out how to rein that in through accountability mechanisms is quite challenging. Obviously, lots of people are trying to think this through right now, but I also think that the public willingness to believe that accountability can be instituted has been exhausted. Certainly after the first round of Black Lives Matter protests in 2014, 2015, the Obama administration tried to mollify protesters by saying that they were going to institute procedural reforms, they were going to create new forms of accountability, there was going to be oversight from the Department of Justice. 5 years later, the effects of that have been nil. And I think protesters in general, as well as the wider public, are not really, they don't really believe that it's possible for those types of reforms and mechanisms of accountability to have any major effect. And that's part of the reason why, on the one hand, the protests are so vibrant and widespread, because people are so frustrated. And on the other hand, I think it explains why the protests have taken up the abolitionist language of defunding and dismantling, because people, they're fed up and they just don't believe that the liberal reform mechanisms will have the types of effect needed. And certainly it's been my experience, watching videos and even being at protests and experiencing the police reaction. It's been my sense that, of course, many police officers at these protests, don't do much of anything, but some who are extremely aggressive and violent, I just don't see how, accountability or oversight could actually do anything about that, because there's no way that anybody would behave that way unless they believed that there would be, strong levels of impunity. And without the maybe it's just to say that it becomes a little bit of a chicken and egg kind of situation that requires just a much more thorough, transformation of the entire institution. It can't be solved by, hinting that maybe there will be accountability, or that accountability will, go beyond just a kind of nibbling around the edges.
The guys and I love doing the podcast. Being able to share our experiences in the military with allies and supporters means the world to us. But we can't do all the work. We need you to share an episode of ours with someone, anyone whom you might think might be affected by it. Young people looking to join the military, or parents advocating for one, conscientious citizens who care about the violence the U.S. wages in their name, advocates for women and people of color who understand the harsh environment the military creates for females and minorities and inflicts on minorities around the globe, and anyone else you think it might affect, please take a moment, pause the episode, share this with them. Now, our podcast is supported in a few different ways. First, there's Patreon, where we're blessed to have an array of wonderful supporters helping the guys and I pay for some of the podcast's expenses. Those who contribute $10 a month or more will be mentioned right here as an honorary producer, helping keep you, our listeners, stocked with new episodes. But you don't have to contribute $10 a month to help us. For as little as a dollar a month, you can keep us going, paying for hosting and storage fees, transcribing old and new episodes, promoting and expanding the podcast, and more I'm sure I can't think of at the moment. So, let's bring out these honorary producers. And they are Will Arenz, Fahim Shirazi, James Zobar, Adam Bellows, Eric Phillips, Paul Appel, Julie Dupree, Thomas Benson, Emma P., Janet Hansen, Lawrence Taylor, Tristan Oliver, Marwan Marwan, and the Status Quo Podcast. Your contributions are wonderfully helpful to us. Thank you so much. However, if Patreon isn't your style, you can always contribute directly to us through PayPal at paypal.me/ForSonaHill. Or please check out our store on Spreadshirt.com. Make sure you check for promo codes before you order. And now, let's get back to the podcast. Yeah, that's all I've been anticipating is just that, you know, like you said, nibbling around the edges, not even attempting to get to a substantive place with identifying the problem, let alone a solution. One area of hope that I have, though, is there's been some court cases recently that have where courts have made police officers more accountable because their department regulations required them to be, and it said that, you know, if your organization told you you were supposed to do this and you didn't do it, yes, we can hold that against you. And so maybe in the interim, to a certain point, because without fixing qualified immunity, this really doesn't do anything, but maybe there's a chance for people to advocate more for regulations of a specific department, and that can have kind of a cross chatter between it in legal terms.
I think that's right. And I think that, you know, police are worried about, you know, individual municipalities, you know, making changes and starting a kind of wave of changes. And the reason I think that they're worried about that is because they see how so many trends in policing, you know, happen in these kind of waves where, you know, a technology will be adopted or a certain practice will be adopted in one place and, you know, eventually, you know, sweep across the nation. Because police, even though there are so many different police departments in the United States and they're all, you know, functionally independent, they actually are deeply intertwined through all sorts of both, you know, explicit institutional networks and kind of, you know, hidden, you know, social and interpersonal networks. So I think that there is a fear to some degree that once the kind of ball gets rolling, to use a cliche, that it'll be hard to stop. And so that indicates why there is, I think, a very strong amount of resistance to what seem like very mild reforms in many cases. And I certainly am not opposed to mild reforms. I just think that we need to recognize that mild reforms are not going to fix this, you know, this problem that is of such a great magnitude. I think we need to, in some sense, try everything. We need to have a wide range of methods to address the problems of policing and racism and inequality that go hand in hand. But we also need to keep in mind that the small, you know, the low hanging fruit or the easy, for some reason I'm full of cliches today, the easy reforms are not going to solve the problem, even if it might still be a good idea to do them nonetheless.
You know, I really think it's interesting what you're saying about how the 2014 sort of initial Black Lives Matter wave, you know, was not, you know, mollified by the promises that weren't kept or didn't have the effects. And Henry's question is so interesting. And, you know, I'm in a flip mood in particular, but this whole idea that, like, the, you know, the progressive left is like the snowflakes and the crybabies, but, you know, so much of what we're seeing, like in that Buffalo incident or in so many other cases of like blue wall solidarity or resignations or pulling back, right, and just like not doing jobs, you know, or as just like petulant protests. I mean, this is in some ways like the ultimate crybaby sort of status. And I do think it comes, like we talked about earlier, at least in part from a notion that you're separate from society. You know, you're not a citizen soldier, you're not a citizen police, you're a professional, or you become a Praetorian guard. And as we talk about this, that's just really like sort of a preface jumping in. And my first involvement in this issue at all, I'm embarrassed to say, was in 2014. I'm from Staten Island, and the Eric Garner case, you know, resonated for that reason, although it shouldn't have been the reason. And then, you know, I was teaching at West Point, so I've come down and, you know, do like the moonlight as a protester. And it was interesting, but it got me thinking about this empire come home thing, right? Which we all is now a cliche, and I'm glad it finally is one, because we couldn't even say empire 10 years ago, right? In public debate.
That's right.
But I guess I'm thinking about your specific book, right? The time period you focus on, and of course it reflects in today, and that always interests me. But one might look at, you know,
what you're studying, this idea of counterinsurgency abroad and at home, and these police training programs. And they might say that there's sort of like two coincidental origins, you know, too many coincidental things, you know, were happening, say, in the early 60s. And so I'm thinking of, you know, Kennedy forms the special forces, counterinsurgency theory gets, you know, big for the first time. And of course, Petraeus brings it back. This is the height of the civil rights movement, the cusp of the drug war, and the onset of like the U.S. role in Vietnam military. Mm-hmm. So that's all happening. So I guess, you know, we've touched a little on it, but if you could give us a bit more on, you know, what's sort of like the takeaway or consequences of these merging currents and contexts, right? I mean, that seems to be really interesting that all that's happening at once in your story.
Absolutely. And I think you've laid out a number of the key coordinates. In some sense, all of the ingredients pre-existed the Kennedy administration. And originally when I started working on the book, I really thought it was going to, you know, start on, you know, in January of 1961. But then I realized I had to draw back further because all of these elements are pre-existing. Certainly, you know, there's special operations in the military, you know, before the Kennedy administration. There is police assistance to other countries before the Kennedy administration. What the Kennedy administration calls counterinsurgency, you know, they popularized that term. Of course, many of the ideas that go into that are already in existence, and some you know, aspects of U.S. military experience provide, you know, quite a lot of historical kind of guidance. Although in the 1960s they weren't so good at looking backward at previous experience, but it was there. And then, of course, the struggle of African American people against racism in the United States is not new in the 1960s. But it is absolutely the case that all of these things, as well as some other factors that I look at in the book, including some, you know, intellectual trends, they all converge. And part of why they converge is that the Kennedy administration has this orientation toward the so-called third world, which is about action, which is about economic and political development, and which is about, you know, rolling back communism, or at the very least containing and maybe rolling back communism. And this is in the context of the continued you know, nationalist and decolonization struggles around the globe, the crumbling of the French and British and other empires, and the fear that you know, both Moscow and Beijing are soliciting support among these newly emerging nations. So the Kennedy administration does dedicate a number of resources to the special forces, to, you know, the creation of the Green Berets and so forth. And that's important. And I think that in general, among historians who've looked at this period, and certainly, you know, with Petraeus, the way that Petraeus revived a certain set of beliefs and theories about counterinsurgency, there was a lot of focus on the Green Berets. There was a lot of focus on special warfare. But when I went into the archives, what I found was that, in fact, the idea of using kind of special forces as a kind of offensive guerrillas, let's put it that way. On the one hand, this was not very successful. And on the other hand, many of the people who advocated this approach fell out of favor in the Kennedy administration. One of the reasons they fell out of favor was, of course, the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was kind of the most spectacular failure of this type of activity. But it was also happening in Vietnam. There were, you know, black operations across the border and from the sea into North Vietnam, where basically in almost every situation or every case, the guerrillas that U.S. Special Forces trained, who were typically from Vietnam, you know, they would just get killed outright. They had very little success. So So these operations are happening. They keep failing. They create these kind of PR disasters in the case of the Bay of Pigs. And all the while, the police assistance program is ongoing. And the police assistance program is during the 1950s. It basically starts officially at the end of 1954. By the end of the 50s, it's called the Overseas Internal Security Program. As it continues to operate, it seems to be having some success in a number of countries around the globe in preventing rebellions or revolutions by various forms of militants, whether they're actually, you know, officially consider themselves communists or not. The police assistance program seems to be effective at strengthening the police in other countries, and they're able to put down rebellions. They're able to interfere with smuggling of contraband. They're able to, you know, track down various and sundry figures that are either criminals or subversives or some combination of the two. So there's a guy on the National Security Council whose name is Robert Comer. And he has the ear of John F. Kennedy. And he says, you know, look, you're interested in counterinsurgency. You're interested in preventing revolution in third world countries. This approach of using, you know, special forces to train, you know, guerrillas to sneak over the border and run amok is just not really up to the task, because countering insurgency means preventing it from breaking out in the very first place. And the only really effective tool to prevent insurgency from breaking out in the first place is modern, well-equipped police forces. And that's what we're doing with our police assistance program. It's cheap. It has a small footprint. Like, let's make better use of it. And ultimately, he's able to convince a number of powerful figures, including the president himself, to dedicate more resources to the police assistance program. And so in 1962, they opened the Office of Public Safety, and that becomes the kind of centralized directorate for these police assistance programs, which until that point had been relatively dispersed and kind of, it's a little complicated, but they were not under, you know, centralized oversight. So now they're under centralized oversight after 62 with the Office of Public Safety, OPS. The director is a guy named Byron Engel, who had been with the CIA in the 1950s and engaged in this kind of police assistance work around the globe, going back to the end of World War II. So Engel, you know, shepherds the Office of Public Safety as it grows, and they start offering this police assistance to a number of countries. And again, they are quite explicit that what they're doing is counterinsurgency. They use that term. Even as some of the kind of elites of the counterinsurgency world, whether Ed Lansdale or some of the French theorists, you know, they keep a little bit of distance from Engel and the Office of Public Safety. They're certainly aware of what's going on, but you know, they see their expertise as having a somewhat more military flavor. Although arguably what they're basically trying to introduce is military forces that can engage in police-like activities. So everybody wants to kind of protect his own turf. And certainly for Engel, he feels if there's too much overlap between what he's doing and what some of the other agencies within the government, US government are doing, well then, you know, his budget might be first on the chopping block. So he tries to create a little bit of space between himself and again, figures like Lansdale and so forth. Ultimately, Lansdale falls out of favor. And then when you go into his papers, which I've done, and you see kind of his behind the scenes correspondence, well, he's talking a lot about policing, and the people around him are talking a lot about policing. And in fact, Lansdale's closest collaborator is a guy named Charles Bohannon. And Charles Bohannon's closest collaborator is a guy from the Philippines named Napoleon Valeriano. Well, it ends up that, you know, this guy, Valeriano, he is actually, you know, working with the Office of Public Safety. So when you see the full picture and you step back a little bit from the kind of romantic vision that the Kennedys put forth in terms of the Green Berets, or you step away from some of the kind of celebrities who cultivate their own air of mystery, like Ed Lansdale, you see that actually at the practical level, where the resources are going and who has the greatest amount of influence is the Office of Public Safety. And I would just add that, you know, the way to understand that is that, as I mentioned at the outset, the Office of Public Safety is operating ultimately in 52 countries on three continents. When most people, you know, today refer back to the 60s and counterinsurgency, they think of South Vietnam. South Vietnam, of course, a huge amount of resources from the United States were dedicated to counterinsurgency there. But in fact, if you go to the Kennedy Library, if you go to the Johnson Library, and you look at the files that are labeled counterinsurgency, they are not just talking about Vietnam. They're talking about, you know, the entirety of the global South, where many countries they feel are at risk of hosting a communist insurgency, and upgrading the police in those countries is the only way to prevent that from happening. So that's you know, one kind of historical through line that I try to you know, both unearth and then trace in Badges Without Borders.
So, Henry, if it's good, I'm gonna follow on with one last kind of extensive question of mine before turning it back to you. You know, your answers are so interesting because they touch on so many things that I could go into, and there's a lot of opportunity for connection here, which I think is one of the strengths of really just the work and the analysis and thesis in general. But you mentioned how, you know, it wasn't all about South Vietnam. And I think there have even been some, you know, policy and foreign policy analysts, you know, generally of the more interventionist bent, who've even gone so far as to say, well, did the United States really lose the Vietnam War because the real prize was Indonesia, right? And which raises a whole bunch of questions. And so I was thinking about this. I remember when I was teaching freshmen at West Point, you know, I was teaching U.S. history, and, you know, you fit it into 40 lessons, but I really liked paintings and cartoons and photos, you know, as just kind of pedagogical tools. And I used to show them a lot of Soviet propaganda from the era that you're writing in, you know, and it's lynching propaganda. It's, you know, police brutality against African-Americans. It's usually racialized, you know, and showing some of the flaws, right, in the American model. And I used to ask them, you know, about this, what do they think? And of course, most of the students, you know, these are West Point freshmen, and, well, how dare the Soviets say that they were murdering all kinds of people? And correct, you know. And I would say, well, you know, they may be hypocrites, but are they strictly wrong? And of course, that would raise a whole bunch of questions. So that leads me to sort of the lack of, or it, what appears to be, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, the lack of sufficient human rights preconditions or caveats with the many of the 52 regimes, right, or governments that we're talking about. And, you know, one thinks of Central America, of course, probably parts of Africa, but especially Asia. And, you know, what are the unintended consequences, short and long term, or maybe intended, of supporting the police, right? Supporting the militaries, the paramilitaries in these countries, you know, and then of course we'll talk ethics, but ethics aside, perhaps, you know, try if it's possible to sort of answer the cynic's cudgel, the whole, does it matter, right? It's all about strategy, realpolitik, no one really cares about ethics anyway. So that's kind of a broad jump, but I think it's an important question because it's thrown so often at us to dismiss this history of working with, you know, terrible regimes.
Yeah, I think it's really important what you say. I mean, certainly, you know, on the ethical level, we can look at Indonesia, you know, and you know, so there's a new book called The Jakarta Method by Vincent Bevins, which I wrote a review of in the Boston Review. And this book does a really fantastic job of kind of synthesizing some of the latest scholarly knowledge about the genocide in Indonesia and pinpointing the U.S. role. You know, and one thing I wrote about in my review was to kind of extend some of the analysis that Bevins does based on my knowledge of police assistance. Of course, ultimately, The genocide that occurred in Indonesia beginning in 1965 was led by the military, and paramilitaries took part in it. But the police assistance program also played an important role, and the U.S. police assistance program, insofar as it created a very highly capable police force that was focused on politics. Really, that was the purpose of it. And the skills that the U.S. cultivated among this police force were about keeping track of targets, intelligence targets. And so when we kind of step back and think about even situations that don't ultimately culminate in a genocide, the way that the aftermath of the coup in Indonesia in 1965 did, but we look at other countries, what we see is that the enhancement that the police assistance program allowed of the counterintelligence programs in various countries, it enabled political crackdowns on people who, in some cases, may have been outright subversives. They may have been trying to overthrow the government, but in many cases, they weren't. They were just merely political dissidents, because I think the logic of counterintelligence is to make associations that might not be political associations between people, but just might be personal, interpersonal or social associations, make them into political associations. And so the web of kind of suspicion is always growing. Everybody who's caught in that web is treated as potentially a subversive, and it just goes it grows and grows and grows and goes in wider and wider directions. Certainly this was the case, with anti-communist counterintelligence within the United States during the Cold War. And it's true in all of these places. So the United States builds up the capabilities of police around the globe to investigate and ultimately, neutralize in various ways people who are caught in these webs of suspicion, which are ultimately always growing in size, and always growing in reach. The result then is, of course, on the one hand, as you mentioned, is an ethical problem, which is that it leads to massive amounts of violence by the state. But on the other hand, I would also argue that it was ultimately politically ineffective for the objective it was trying to achieve. If the objective it was trying to achieve was lessening political dissidents, lessening political subversion, weakening the appeal and public support for left-wing political movements, it didn't have that effect. It had the opposite effect. It increased the sympathy that people had for the left as they saw people who were, trade union leaders or student leaders who were never engaged in violence, end up getting disappeared by security forces. That increased the sympathy. So ultimately, I think, even if somebody wants to, take ethics out of it, and refer only to the strategic and geopolitical goals, it is absolutely true that during the Cold War, the United States shot itself in the foot repeatedly, over and over and over again, in terms of actually achieving its goals, because what it did was incite or provoke the very political movements that it was afraid of in the first place. I mean, I've been looking lately at the Uruguay case. Uruguay, in the early part of the 1960s was considered the quote unquote, Switzerland of Latin America or something. It was this very peaceful, relatively prosperous place. Nearby countries were engaging in greater and greater amounts of political repression, including Brazil, and Uruguay was open to political refugees from other countries coming in. But at the same time, Uruguay started to see some political protests growing because there started to be economic stagnation. The police responded to these political protests vociferously, and ultimately the Office of Public Safety starts a police assistance program in Uruguay. and they are able to clamp down on demonstrations. And once authorized, typical demonstrations that we might expect to see in any democratic country are prevented from occurring. Well, what does the left do? The left goes underground and it starts to try to find other routes to manifest its political dissidence. And ultimately that leads toward, brazen acts, bank robberies, and then ultimately, kidnappings and some other forms of political violence. I think that we can pretty clearly argue, looking at the history of the Office of Public Safety's interventions in Uruguay, and based on the evidence from what the leftist militants themselves said, is that the repression created the resistance, right? And so you can find this in a number of countries across the globe in the Cold War period. And it just, to me, it is a really strong indicator that if somebody is willing to set the ethical questions aside, which I don't think they should, but if they are and they want to just focus on the geostrategic goals, the United States was unsuccessful and it really provoked a lot of what it was trying to prevent. And just to, bring it up to the present in 2020, that's absolutely what's been happening with a lot of these protests, is that in the guise of controlling the protests, the police have overreacted, and they've provoked the protests to be more widespread, more intense, and more resolute. So I think that the history provides a set of cautionary lessons, even for people who might think of themselves as kind of cold-blooded and sober, and their minds are unclouded by ethical considerations. I think if you do that, you find that actually this history is one of repeated failure.
Yeah, I just want to thank you for that answer. I mean, it's a leading question that's sort of built on a frustration with, I think, what we kind of both agree is a tendency to, divest sort of the ethical from the strategic, when in reality you're pointing out that in some cases they are linked, and and like America's imperial wars, some of this has often been counterproductive for these countries in terms of its boomerang back home, and all that. And before I bow over to Henry, I just want to say that I read your review of the Jakarta method, and I will say it was excellent. And I have like one bone to pick with you, which is that the Jakarta method is sitting on my shelf right now. And the review is like so excellent and just kind of like an analysis so comprehensive. I'm like, man, maybe I won't read the book. I will. I promise.
You should. It's a wonderful book. Yeah.
Bevan should know that I totally am reading the book. So thank you for that. That was awesome. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great place for us to wrap it up today. Stuart, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a really great conversation. I really appreciated hearing your perspectives, because of course you have a very different set of life experiences from mine. But I think that it's great to hear that my work has been helpful for making sense of some of this.
Oh yeah, no, the book is amazing. I really enjoyed it. Will you let the listeners know real quick where they can find your work?
Absolutely. You can pick up Badges Without Borders from any bookshop. I encourage you to use independent bookshops. You can also pick it up from the University of California Press, the publisher. If you go to the University of California Press website and search for the book, it'll take you to a page that lists the book, and there's a little thing on the side of the page that says something like, click here to create a flyer. And you would probably look at that and say, well, why would I want to create a flyer? And the reason is because there's a 30% discount code that you can get on the flyer if you click on there. And so that's the cheapest way to obtain the book. And you can find me easily at stuartschrader.com or on Twitter at stschrader. And the number one. And I'd be happy to hear from your listeners.
All right. Well, thanks again for doing this, Stuart. And I hope that you'll be a guest again.
Thank you.
We're on Twitter at Fortress on a Hill, and also at Facebook.com at Fortress on a Hill. You can find our main blog page and our full collection of episodes at www.fortressonahill.com. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Patreon, Spotify. You name it, almost anywhere you listen, we're already waiting for you. And hey, we're always in the market for more Patreon supporters. Please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com. And if you're not into giving us a monthly payment, think about giving us a couple bucks on PayPal. The link is in the show notes. Skepticism is one's best armor. Never forget it. We'll see you next time.
And listen to my song. I hope you'll pay attention. I will not be